Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. for KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck. Bring a birthday cake if you can and celebrate the existence of 51 wonderful years of grassroots, volunteer-run, independent community radio serving Portland, Cascadia, and the world. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shared knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. Again, that's KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck on Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/51birthday party.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
Up next is One Land, Many Voices.
Tonight, I'll deal with the topic, do the Israeli snipers on the perimeter of Gaza, do they have a right to self-defense? As would seem to be the case, judging by what human rights organizations have been reporting and analyzing. I will also, at the end of my remarks, I will look at the most recent developments, which I think are not terminal, but they are ominous, and they will mark another setback in the efforts to achieve justice in the Israel-Palestine conflict. I think things are headed in a negative direction, but I don't think it's irreversible. And I'll get to that at the end of my presentation. So, I know I have a very formidable challenge this evening, because there's a young woman who I estimate at 7 years old sitting in the second row who has very high standards, exacting standards, demanding standards of excellence, and I'm going to have to sustain your interest, young lady, because I don't want to see you be taking out some iPad and watching some cartoon at my expense, because I did not travel all the way from New York City to have my ego punctured in, of all places, Portland, Oregon, which the best it can show for itself is something named Ernest Bloch, who I think we can all agree is not a Van Gogh. Since March 30th of last year, there have been ongoing demonstrations in Gaza to try fundamentally to lift the siege of Gaza, the blockade that's been imposed on it. There is a certain amount of ambiguity in the demands of the people of Gaza. It began as a demonstration to recall for the world the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes from 1948. However, at a certain point, several weeks into the demonstrations, the focus turned to trying to lift the blockade of Gaza, and the demonstrations have been unusually disciplined, courageous, and protracted. Some of you may recall, if you follow the developments there closely, the original expectation was they would last approximately 6 weeks. They would go from March 30th, which is called Land Day in that part of the world, until May 15th, which is the day marking the expulsion of the Palestinian population from its homeland. But it soon became apparent to the people of Gaza that you have to be in for the long haul. This was a very difficult nut to crack, and that it's going to take much longer than 6 weeks. I actually was quite optimistic at the beginning, but something didn't happen which I expected would happen, and that changed the calculus. As you know, or most of you in the room presumably know, there's always this talk, in particular on the social media, about when is there going to be the third intifada? When is there going to be the third intifada, the third revolt against the Israeli occupation? And lo and behold, before our eyes, the third intifada burst on the scenes in the form of the mass, overwhelmingly nonviolent resistance in Gaza, of a kind that's particularly heroic and courageous, because on each Friday, the climax being Friday, May 14th, these overwhelmingly nonviolent resistors were being mowed down by the Israeli snipers. And you might have expected, you might have thought, that the solidarity movement would immediately start holding demonstrations and mass nonviolent civil resistance in the various venues where they are concentrated in support of the people of Gaza. But it didn't happen. And the people of Gaza, as I said, it was quite a sobering shock to me. The people of Gaza were abandoned, forsaken, left to their own devices, and abandoned, forsaken, left to their own devices, of course, they cannot win. That's impossible. Israel will finally either erode their will or drive them to resume what's called armed resistance. And for the life of me, it's kind of unfathomable. I just don't quite get why this solidarity movement seems to think whether or not Madonna performs in Tel Aviv is of more significance and importance than lending a hand, lending support to the people of Gaza in their moment of truth. Be that as it may, it's now about 1 year and 2 months since the demonstrations began, and they keep going. They keep coming out. They keep getting killed with less and less media attention. It's now lasted longer, for those of you who have a historical memory, these demonstrations have now lasted longer than the Montgomery bus boycott, which was almost exactly a year in the making before the city finally capitulated. The international community has strongly condemned Israel's armed response to these overwhelmingly nonviolent demonstrations. Almost immediately, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution deploring the use of any excessive, disproportionate, and indiscriminate force by the Israeli forces against Palestinian civilians. Today, or I should say approximately a week or two after the peak of the Israeli brutality in Gaza, Human Rights Watch issued what was really a quite excellent report, and it said that Israeli forces' repeated use of lethal force in the Gaza Strip against demonstrators who posed no imminent threat to life may amount to war crimes. The climax, the culmination of these human rights condemnations came about a month or two ago, when the UN Human Rights Council, a three-member commission, issued a really very professional, authoritative, serious report on the situation in Gaza. I had followed the developments fairly closely, but I must say I was much illuminated by what was in that report. There was a lot of material in there, and I will return to that towards the end of my remarks. The question, however, I want to pose today is, even if it's acknowledged that the condemnations of Israeli conduct have been welcome, the question nonetheless remains whether these condemnations have gone far enough. The question I would put to you this evening is, does Israel have the right to use any force under any circumstances against the people of Gaza? The intuitive response is to say, much as I don't want to have to admit it, of course they have that sacred, unassailable right to self-defense. But I will try to persuade you that the intuitive response, that right of self-defense, is in the circumstances of Gaza and comparable circumstances, that right does not exist. The current debate among human rights organizations and Israel's supporters generally comes down to the question, did Israeli snipers, or have Israeli snipers, resorted to excessive and disproportionate force against the demonstrators? That's the position of places like Human Rights Watch Amnesty International, the UN General Assembly, Israel has used excessive or disproportionate force, whereas Israel's supporters, they claim that Israel has used the amount of force necessary to prevent protesters from breaching the perimeter fence. So basically, the polls in the debate, the spectrum is disproportionate, excessive force versus necessary force as a right of self-defense, either of the snipers themselves or of the Israeli communities abutting the perimeter fence with Gaza. Now, you will notice that all the parties to the debate, they proceed from a common premise. The premise is that Israel does have a right to use force in order to prevent Gazans from breaching the fence. That's the common premise. The dispute comes down to this. Those who allege that Israel has used disproportionate or excessive force, the human rights organizations, they tacitly legitimize Israel's right to use proportionate or moderate force. You can't use disproportionate and excessive force, but that seems to suggest you do have the right to use proportionate or moderate force. But the fact is, Israel cannot claim a right to use any force in Gaza, whether it be moderate or excessive, whether it be proportionate or disproportionate, whether the protesters are armed or unarmed, and whether or not the protesters do or don't pose an imminent threat to life. It appears otherwise, but that's because the current debate in the mainstream, and including the human rights organizations, they ignore what international law actually has to say on the topic, and they abstract from the specific situation in Gaza. So, let's begin with the law. What does the law have to say about this right to self-defense and the right to use force? Let's start with the basics. The Palestinian people in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, they're struggling to realize their internationally validated right to self-determination. As the International Court of Justice ruled in 2004. Now the law, as it's interpreted by the leading scholars in the field, they say that according to the law, an occupying power, in this case Israel, an occupying power is not allowed to use force to suppress a popular insurrection in a self-determination struggle. An occupying power does not have, under international law, the right to use force to suppress a struggle for self-determination. The right to self-determination under international law is one of those basic rights There are fancy terms for it for those who follow the scholarly literature. It's called the jus cogens, right? That means there are no exceptions to this right. And so obviously, if that's the case, Israel cannot have the right to use force to deny the people of the occupied Palestinian territories of the right to use, deny their right to self-determination by using force. On the other hand, international law does not prohibit a people struggling for self-determination to use force in order to achieve their fundamental right. As it happens, the demonstrators in Gaza have chosen to use nonviolence in pursuit of their right to self-determination, but that's a politically prudent decision. Had they chosen to use force in order to achieve their right to self-determination, there's nothing in international law that says they can't use it. The only thing that international law does say categorically, without equivocation, is that an occupying power, in this case Israel, does not have the right to resort to military force. Now that, you will notice, is quite contrary to how the law is depicted when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, because it's typically said that Israel has the right to use violent force in self-defense against Gazans, whereas we're told that the people of Gaza and the West Bank are obliged to wage their struggle for self-determination non-violently. That's an exact reversal of the law. The law says it's Israel that must use nonviolent means, whereas it's the Palestinians who, under international law, have the right to use force if they so choose. The UN Special Coordinator on the peace process, this kind of creepy guy, Nikolai Mladenov. So he writes in one of his recent reports, all factions in Gaza must refrain from illicit arms buildup and militant activity on the ground. Well, that's exactly wrong. The factions in Gaza are not under any legal obligation from arms buildup or militant activity on the ground. In fact, under international law, nothing bars a foreign power, in the case at hand, say the Islamic Republic of Iran, from providing the people of Gaza with weapons. There is absolutely nothing in international law that prohibits or bars that. Whereas Mladenov and his ilk say nothing about the obligation, which is real under international law, that Israel must refrain from its arm buildup and militant activity on the ground to suppress the Palestinian struggle for self-determination. Now, some of you who know the law are thinking, well, I think he's kind of misrepresenting the law. because Israel is, under international law, an occupying power, and one of the rights under the Fourth Geneva Convention that is one of the rights that's accorded the occupying power is the right to what's called maintain public order. And so, doesn't Israel have the right as an occupying power to maintain public order in the territories over which it exercises its occupation? That's wrong on several counts. I'll just address two. Number one, the fundamental purpose of the Fourth Geneva Convention is not to endow occupiers with rights, but on the contrary, as the subtitle of the Fourth Geneva Convention says, its purpose is, and now I'm quoting the subtitle of the Fourth Geneva Convention, its purpose is the protection of civilian persons in time of war. Has Israel, as the occupying power, has it protected the civilian population in Gaza? Well, that to me is a fairly uncomplicated question. It's one of those questions that don't require an extensive application of your mental powers. Israel has subjected Gaza's civilian population to a protracted siege that amounts to illegal collective punishment. Gaza now has either reached the point or is approaching the point where it has become unlivable. Now, if instead of protecting civilians in time of war, you've created a nightmare situation in Gaza such that the place already is or is rapidly approaching a state of unlivability, then you don't have the right to maintain order if the disorder is a consequence of you creating an unlivable situation in Gaza. You can't claim under the Fourth Geneva Convention the right to maintain order if you have not lived up to your responsibility of the protection of civilian persons, especially when the disorder is a consequence of the fact that you are strangulating the people of Gaza. Now, the second point to bear in mind on this question of whether Israel as an occupying power has the right to maintain public order is Israel would have that right if Israel's occupation of Gaza was legal, if it were legal. But Israel's occupation of Gaza at this point in time, in my opinion, has ceased to be a legal occupation for a very simple and I think transparent reason, which is the occupation, what makes an occupation under international law. There's one fundamental characteristic of an occupation, and that fundamental characteristic is it's supposed to be temporary. If it ceases to be temporary, it's no longer an occupation. I think it's reasonable to infer that after more than a half century, and in as much as none of the major political groupings in Israel is committed to ending its rule of Gaza, the reasonable inference, the reasonable conclusion is it's no longer an occupation. It's an annexation. You can either call it, you can denote it, an illegal occupation, the kind of occupation that existed from 1971 on in Namibia. The South African occupation of Namibia became, under the terms of the UN Security Council, International Court of Justice, and General Assembly, it officially became an illegal occupation, or you can call it an annexation. But you can't, in my opinion, any longer call it, because it's a distortion, a falsification of reality. You can't any longer call it an occupation, because, as I said, the fundamental premise of an occupation is it's supposed to end. And one of the preconditions of judging whether or not an occupation will or will not end, it's what the International Court of Justice, in the case of Namibia, referred to as good faith negotiations. You have to show, as the occupying power, that you are engaging in good faith negotiations to end that occupation. Well, in the case of Israel, there's no requirement of any deep-seated understanding of this so-called peace process. Israel has declared in all of its major political groupings it's not ending the occupation. So there are no good faith negotiations. And so I think it's correct to say it is an annexation. I don't want to go into that too much, but I would make the point that although it was a surprise that after Mr. Netanyahu's last electoral victory, the New York Times, in an editorial, lamented that Israel now seems well on its way to becoming something that many Jews, who were supporters of Israel for so long, must find morally very unpalatable, that Israel is going to be the only country on earth that legally resembles South Africa. I think one can say soberly, rationally, without any hysteria or fanfare, that Israel now is an apartheid state, because the territories have been de facto annexed. And so you have, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, a population of about 12 million. Of those 12 million, about 6.5 million have roughly the same rights as the white folks had in South Africa. You have another population, the Arab citizens of Israel, who have what you might call second-class status, I think pretty close to the Indian population inside South Africa during the apartheid era. And then you have approximately a little more than 4.5 million people who have no rights whatsoever as a legal matter, as a fact that apartheid is under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. It's a crime against humanity. As a technical legal matter, Israel is an apartheid state, de facto, because the territories have been annexed by Israel. So, having been annexed, the occupation now being illegal, they have no right to maintain order. They only have one right. As an occupying power, you have a right to stay. But once the occupation has become illegal, you have, just as the U.S. representative said in the United Nations when Namibia, its occupation was declared illegal, he said the occupying power has only one right, and that's to leave. They have no rights anymore except the right to pack up your bags and to go. That's the law. Let's try to think or look at it in a slightly less technical form, and let's see where we get if we don't look at it in terms of the Geneva Conventions and what legal experts have to say, but just to apply a little bit of common sense. There's a tenet of law that says no rights can be derived from illegal acts. If you've done something illegal, you can't claim after having committed that illegal right act that you have a right. Now there is a Latin version of it, but I never had a very good command of languages by virtue of my accent, so I won't read it to you, especially because it's going to be awful Latin, and it's going to sound like Tallulah Bankhead. For those of you who know who she is, with the raspy voice, you do. Don't give away, don't be too proud of that, because you've just dated yourself about, you're well past 80. So, it's obvious, or ought to be obvious, that a right to self-defense does not obtain in all situations. So let's see, we're going to test the brain power of the People's Republic of Portland. So far, in terms of your artistic and literary achievements, I would say there's not much to write home about. But let's see sheer brain power. Who here can describe an act which, once committed, strips you of any subsequent acts or subsequent rights, for example, the right to self-defense? Okay, we have a young man sitting in the second row. He looks like if you were in the 1960s, you would clearly have been a flower child. I could see you in the song, if you're going to San Francisco, make sure you have a flower in your hair. Do you know that song? Let me back up. Have you ever heard of San Francisco? Okay. Now,
I've heard of flowers too.
You've heard of flowers too. Put the two together and what do you get? Okay, give me an act which once committed or having been committed strips you of any right to self-defense.
A crime.
Well, give me an example. Can you be more concrete?
If you murder somebody.
Well, then we'll be a little bit late in the day. But you're on the right track. Give me a crime where the person against whom you're perpetrating the crime might use force And if that person used force against you, you can't claim a right to self-defense.
Right.
Exactly. The most obvious example is rape. If you attempt to rape a person and the person resists by pummeling you or biting you, you can't claim a right to self-defense against that person. Or as that simple legal principle says, no rights can be derived from illegal acts. Once you've committed that illegal act, you lose any claim to a right to self-defense. Or to take another example, a theater owner has no right to self-defense if patrons attack him after he sets the building ablaze and impedes their flight. Now, you may laugh, and you might think, well, that's obviously true. If it were opening night of the Wizard of Oz, and the theater owner has assembled a huge crowd waiting to hear Judy Garland sing Over the Rainbow, or Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, or any of those classics. And then the theater owner, who in another life, concealed from the public, is a pyromaniac. The crowd having been assembled, he takes out his cans of gasoline, circles the building, sets it afire, and then people come pouring out of the building. He's impeding their flight, blocking them. They are filled with rage, and they start beating him, and he says, how dare you? I have a right to self-defense. And that's transparently ludicrous. You look like that theater owner. I'm just have that look like I'm revealing a hidden chapter in your life. You sought refuge in Portland? Okay. And in my opinion, and we'll see whether or not you'll agree, Israel's conduct vis-a-vis Gaza falls into the same category of acts that render null and void the right to self-defense. If that were not true, if I were mistaken, then it would amount to the right of Israel to use military force in order to maintain an illegal occupation compounded by an illegal blockade. Now you have to ask yourself the question, does that make any sense? Can Israel have the right to use force in order to maintain an illegal occupation compounded by an illegal blockade? Because if you claim they have this right to self-defense, or as human rights organizations say, their right to use force if the people of Gaza present an imminent threat to their lives, either the lives of the snipers or the lives of the adjoining Jewish communities in the south of Israel, you're in effect saying that they have the right to use force to maintain an illegal occupation compounded by an illegal siege. Does that make sense? if it's nonetheless widely held that Israel has the right to use force to prevent Gazans from breaching the border fence, that's because most of these debates hinge on the technicalities of law that obscure the human stakes in what's going on in Gaza. So, let's start with the basics. What is Gaza? It's a narrow coastal strip. It's among the most densely populated areas on the planet. More than 70% of Gaza's population of 2 million, more than 70% are refugees. For over a decade, Israel has placed this speck of land under a devastating siege. More than 50% of Gaza's workforce is now unemployed. It has the highest unemployment of anywhere on this planet. More than 50% live below the poverty line. 80% depend on international food aid. 97% of the water in Gaza is contaminated. For the first quarter of 2018, Gaza's economy registered a negative 6% growth. What's causing this humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza? It's no secret. You look at the reports of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, UNCTAD, the UN agency, or 10,000 other reports. I have never in my life seen so many reports devoted to Gaza's economy when Gaza has no economy. It's just kind of mind-boggling. I'm talking about thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of reports by all of these UN and NGO organizations on an economy that doesn't exist. But on one point, there is a consensus. What's causing this disaster? Is it, as we're often told, Hamas mismanagement? Is it the usual Arab corruption and incompetence? No, the explanation is pretty straightforward. It's the blockade. Israel doesn't let anything go in and doesn't let anything go out. So it ought not to come as a surprise that the economy has collapsed. That's Gaza. Now, we're told that what separates Gaza from Israel, we're told that this fence is a border, as if Gaza were a state. There's this border between two states, Gaza and Israel. But the distinguished Hebrew University professor Baruch Kimmerling, he called Gaza a concentration camp. As he put it, the biggest concentration camp ever. The former UK Prime Minister, the Conservative UK Prime Minister, David Cameron, he called Gaza an open-air prison. The Israeli newspaper, its most distinguished newspaper, Haaretz, called Gaza a ghetto. The Economist called it a human rubbish heap. The International Committee of the Red Cross, it called Gaza a sinking ship. The International Monetary Fund called it a humanitarian catastrophe. The UN human rights chief called it a toxic slum in which an entire civilian population is caged from birth to death. The UN humanitarian coordinator for Gaza, he observed, "I see this extraordinarily inhuman and unjust process of strangling gradually 2 million civilians that really pose a threat to nobody." And then you have to ask the question to yourselves, does Israel have the right to use force to encage Gaza's 1 million children in a ghetto or a toxic slum? Don't the people of Gaza have the right to break free from a concentration camp? Does anyone now debate whether Germany used excessive or disproportionate force to suppress the Warsaw Ghetto uprising? Who now ponders whether Germany had a right to self-defense against the Jewish fighting organization in the ghetto, which, unlike the people of Gaza, resisted with arms in hand? Are such questions even conceivable? Could anybody even think to ask the question whether the Nazi guards along the perimeter of the Warsaw Ghetto had the right to use force against the Jewish resistance? Do they have the right to use force even if there was an imminent threat to the lives of the guards? I dare say, without being too presumptuous, it's very hard for me to imagine that anyone in this room or any room of any sane assembly of people would say that the guards have a right to self-defense, or even if an imminent threat were posed to their lives. Now, some of you will recoil at the analogy, and you'll say, but Gaza is not the Warsaw Ghetto. But as an Israeli journalist who served in Gaza during the first Intifada, for those of you who don't remember, in 1987 to 91, roughly, there was an Israeli journalist named Ari Shavit. He served in Gaza during that period when Gaza was a much better place than it's become in the last couple of decades. He said at the time, the problem is not in the similarity between Gaza and the Warsaw Ghetto. He said the problem is there isn't enough lack of similarity. There isn't enough lack of similarity. Experts predict that Gaza will soon be overrun by typhoid and cholera epidemics of the kind that Yemen has been experiencing, or like the epidemics that decimated the Jewish population in the Warsaw Ghetto. According to the RAND Corporation, already more than a quarter of all reported disease is caused by poor water quality and access. The poor water is the leading cause of childhood morbidity. The risk of an outbreak of a waterborne or other intestinal disease in Gaza is high. The World Health Organization said over 1 million people in the Gaza Strip are at risk of contracting waterborne diseases. This very decent person, some of you will know from her scholarly work, Sarah Roy at Harvard University. She's very smart and also very decent. Her parents were survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. Her father, I'm not sure of her mother. I know her father, and probably I think her mother, were survivors of Auschwitz. And she's the world's leading scholar on Gaza's economy. And as I said, not only a first-rate scholar, but also just a really decent person who I happily can call a friend. And in the new edition of her standard work on Gaza's economy, she wrote, "Innocent human beings, most of them young, are slowly being poisoned by the water they drink and likely by the soil in which they plant. That being the case, the only morally sane question presented by the situation in Gaza, and I would say it ranks as a rhetorical question, the only sane question is, does Israel have the right, in the name of self-defense, to poison 1 million children? Does Israel have that right?" I say it's a rhetorical question, which means at the end of the day, I don't think it's a very complicated question whether the guards along the perimeter of the Gaza ghetto have the right to use any force under any circumstances as a right of self-defense. As you know, there has been an alignment of Israel with the alt-right around the world, whether it be Hungary, Poland, Modi's India, Bolsonaro's Brazil. Israel now is a full-fledged member of the reincarnation from the 1930s, the reincarnation of the global fascist movements. Now we have a global alt-right, a predictable response to the fact that there's been a huge political polarization because of the collapse in large parts of the world of the capitalist economy. And Israel is a bona fide member of that alt-right. There's only two flies in the ointment. Number one, if Bernie Sanders wins in 2020, which I consider to be a reasonable, though very far from certain, prospect, if he wins, that will change all calculations. I think that it will release new forces in our body politic, and there will be real possibilities of influencing the political process. Not just public opinion, where there has been major shifts, but also the political process in our Congress and elsewhere. So that's one change. And then there is the other change, which is the shifts in public opinion, such that large sectors of the Democratic Party have now grown steadily.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices. That's Norman Finkelstein, focusing on the right of self-defense of people under occupation. Up next will be Radio Zine with host Dresden, talking about Design Portland and Higher Thought and the cannabis game.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center in Portland. Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, is a public talk by Grace Kim about the loneliness epidemic in Portland and how co-housing can help. Grace is a principal at Skamata Workshop and a co-founder of Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing in Seattle. The talk is part of the National Co-Housing Conference taking place in Portland, May 30th through June 2nd. Again, that's Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of My Story, My Superpower storytelling show on Wednesday, May 29th at 7 p.m. at the Intel Hawthorne Farm Campus in Hillsborough. My Story, My Superpower features 10 storytellers who will share their stories of courage, hope, and resilience to raise the awareness of mental health as an integral part of individual, organizational, and community wellness. Again, that's My Story, My Superpower storytelling show on Wednesday, May 29th at 7 p.m. at the Intel Hawthorne Farm Campus, 5200 Northeast Ilum Young Parkway in Hillsborough. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO program is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema, open every night and featuring independent foreign and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.